13. The Plain of Rama. After those interminable stairs, it was a strange luxury to walk once more on a horizontal surface. Directly ahead, the ground was indeed completely flat. To right and left, at the limits of the floodlit area, the rising curve could just be detected. They might have been walking along a very wide, shallow valley. It was quite impossible to believe that they were really crawling along the inside of a huge cylinder, and that beyond this little oasis of light, the land rose up to meet, no, to become the sky. Though they all felt a sense of confidence and subdued excitement, after a while, the almost palpable silence of Rama began to weigh heavily upon them. Every footstep, every word, vanished instantly into the unreverberant void. After they had gone little more than half a kilometer, Joe Calvert could stand it no longer. Among his minor accomplishments was a talent now rare, though many thought not rare enough, the art of whistling. With or without encouragement, he could reproduce the themes from most of the movies of the last 200 years. He started appropriately with, "Hi-ho, hi-ho, it's off to work we go," found that he couldn't stay down comfortably in the bass with Disney's Marching Dwarfs, and switched quickly to the River Kwai song. Then he progressed, more or less chronologically, through half a dozen epics, culminating with the theme from Sid Craftsman's famous late 20th century Napoleon. It was a good try, but it didn't work, even as a morale builder. Rama needed the grandeur of Bach or Beethoven or Sibelius or Tuan Soon, not the trivia of popular entertainment. Norton was on the point of suggesting that Joe save his breath for later exertions when the young officer realized the inappropriateness of his efforts. Thereafter, apart from an occasional consultation with the ship, they marched on in silence. Rama had won this round. On this initial traverse, Norton had allowed for one detour. Paris lay straight ahead, halfway between the foot of the stairway and the shore of the cylindrical sea, but only a kilometer to the right of their track was a very prominent and rather mysterious feature, which had been christened the Strait Valley. It was a long groove or trench, 40 meters deep and 100 wide, with gently sloping sides. It had been provisionally identified as an irrigation ditch or canal. Like the stairway, it had two similar counterparts, equally spaced on the curve of Rama. The three valleys were almost 10 kilometers long, and they stopped abruptly just before they reached the sea, which was strange if they were intended to carry water. And on the other side of the sea, the pattern was repeated. Three more 10-kilometer trenches continued on to the region of the South Pole. They reached the near end of the Strait Valley after only 15 minutes' comfortable walking, and stood for a while, staring thoughtfully into its depths. The perfectly smooth walls sloped down at an angle of 60 degrees. There were no steps or footholds. Filling the bottom was a sheet of flat, white material that looked much like ice. A specimen could settle a good many arguments. Norton decided to get one. With Calvert and Rodrigo acting as anchors and playing out a safety rope, he rappelled slowly down the steep incline. When he reached the bottom, he fully expected to find the familiar, slippery feel of ice underfoot, but he was mistaken. The friction was too great. His footing was secure. This material was some kind of glass or transparent crystal. When he touched it with his fingertips, It was cold, hard, and unyielding. Turning his back to the searchlight and shielding his eyes from its glare, Norton tried to peer into the crystalline depths, as one may attempt to gaze through the ice of a frozen lake. But he could see nothing. Even when he tried the concentrated beam of his own helmet lamp, he was no more successful. This stuff was translucent, but not transparent. If it was a frozen liquid, it had a melting point much higher than water. He tapped it gently with the hammer from his geology kit. The tool rebounded with a dull, unmusical clunk. He tapped harder, with no more result, and he was about to exert his full strength when some impulse made him desist. It seemed most unlikely that he could crack this material, but what if he did? He would be like a vandal, smashing some enormous plate glass window. There would be a better opportunity later, and at least he had discovered valuable information. It now seemed most unlikely that this was a canal. It was simply a peculiar trench that stopped and started abruptly, but led nowhere. And if at any time it had carried liquid, where were the stains, the encrustations of dried-up sediment that one would expect? Everything was bright and clean, as if the builders had left only yesterday. Once again, he was face to face with the fundamental mystery of Rama, and this time it was impossible to evade it. Norton was a reasonably imaginative man, but he would never have reached his present position if he had been liable to the wilder flights of fancy. Yet now, for the first time, he had a sense, not exactly of foreboding, but of anticipation. Things were not what they seemed. There was something very odd indeed about a place that was simultaneously brand new and a million years old. Deep in thought, he began to walk slowly along the length of the little valley, while his companions, still holding the rope that was attached to his waist, followed him along the rim. He did not expect to make any further discoveries, but he wanted to let his curious, emotional state run its course. For something else was worrying him, and it had nothing to do with the inexplicable newness of Rama. He had walked no more than a dozen meters when it hit him like a thunderbolt. He knew this place. He had been here before. Even on Earth, or on some familiar planet, that experience is disquieting, though it is not particularly rare. Most men have known it at some time or other, and usually they dismiss it as the memory of a forgotten photograph, a pure coincidence, or, if they are mystically inclined, some form of telepathy from another mind, or even a flashback from their own future. But to recognize a spot that no other human being can possibly have seen, that is quite shocking. For several seconds, Norton stood rooted to the smooth, crystalline surface on which he had been walking, trying to straighten out his feelings. His well-ordered universe had been turned upside down, and he had a dizzying glimpse of those mysteries at the edge of existence that he had successfully ignored for most of his life. Then, to his immense relief, common sense came to the rescue. The disturbing sensation of déjà vu faded out, to be replaced by a real and identifiable memory from his youth. It was true. He had once stood between such steeply sloping walls, watching them drive into the distance until they seemed to converge at a point indefinitely far ahead. But they had been covered with neatly trimmed grass, and underfoot had been broken stone, not smooth crystal. It had happened 30 years ago, during a summer vacation in England. largely because of another student. He could remember her face, but he had forgotten her name. He had taken a course in industrial archaeology, then very popular among science and engineering graduates. They had explored abandoned coal mines and cotton mills, climbed over ruined blast furnaces and steam engines, goggled unbelievingly at primitive, and still dangerous, nuclear reactors, and driven priceless turbine-powered antiques along restored motor roads. Not everything that they saw was genuine. Much had been lost during the centuries, for men seldom bothered to preserve the commonplace articles of everyday life. But where it was necessary to make copies, they had been reconstructed with loving care. And so, young Bill Norton had found himself bowling along at an exhilarating 100 kilometers an hour, while he furiously shoveled precious coal into the firebox of a locomotive that looked 200 years old, but was actually younger than he was. The 30-kilometer stretch of the Great Western Railway, however, was quite genuine, though it had required a good deal of excavating to get it back into commission. With whistle screaming, they had plunged into a hillside and raced through a smoky, flame-lit darkness. An astonishingly long time later, they had burst out of the tunnel into a deep, perfectly straight cutting between steep, grassy banks. The long-forgotten vista was almost identical with the one before him now.
"What is it, Skipper?" called Rodrigo. "Have you found something?"
As Norton dragged himself back to present reality, some of the oppression lifted from his mind. There was mystery here, yes, but it might not be beyond human understanding. He had learned a lesson, though it was not one that he could readily impart to others. At all costs, he must not let Rama overwhelm him. That way lay failure, perhaps even madness.
"No," he answered. "There's nothing down here. Haul me up. We'll head straight to Paris."